Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, we look at ways to help out our communities, even during a pandemic. And we hear from violinist Patrick Contreras. He's performing more than ever from the sidewalk. But first, 1 month since the death of George Floyd, communities across the country are debating the reallocation of funding from law enforcement agencies to social services. But in Bakersfield this week, the city council voted to increase its police budget and hire more officers. The funding came from Measure N, a sales tax passed by voters in 2018 to address community priorities. To get some perspective on the council's decision and learn more about police reform efforts in Kern County, I spoke with African-American community leaders Trago Matthews, a social pastor, Arlena Waller, SheePower Global Ambassador, and Isaiah Crompton with the MLK Community Collaborative. I also reached out to the Bakersfield Police Department and the Kern County Sheriff's Office, but neither agency responded with a representative. Arlena, I'd like to start with you. Following the death of George Floyd, you organized two public forums for community members to talk with the Bakersfield Police Chief and the Kern County Sheriff. How would you characterize those conversations, and have they led to any action at this point?
I think, as you were able to hear, they both had two different takes from the community. I think with the BPD, there is hope. I think with the sheriff, we've got a lot of work to do. So there, we left there and we kind of have started working together. Some people have been doing this work for a very long time. You know, the three of us on this phone have come together and really we've taken some real serious steps that Isaiah and Trako is leading to get a police advisory committee in position, because the police and the sheriffs can no longer police themselves. That was one thing that has come out of it. From the sheriff, we have talked with the undersheriff. The mother that was crying on the phone while her son was beat by four sheriffs, they have filed an investigation. So some good has come out of the conversation.
Isaiah, what are your thoughts?
Well, similar. We did speak with the sheriff by Zoom. And it seemed that we didn't really get any headway, make any grounds. But with the Bakersfield PD, it seems like we may get somewhere with a petition. I had a situation yesterday where my son got shot, and my nephew. I didn't know my nephew had got shot also. So there's a lot going on, but I wasn't able to speak on it at the city council. But I seem to think that we might make some headway with the Bakersfield PD and getting a advisory committee to help us when there's a shooting or when there's a something that happens in our community that we think needs to have another set of eyes on. And, we will be able to do that. And I think the community will feel a little bit safer when they know that we have this advisory committee, and the police will know that, hey, we're not going to, something happens, you won't be able to police yourself. You won't be able to, go within themselves and say, oh, it was justified. There will be another set of eyes on what's going on. And I think that's very important. That's very vital. But it's only a piece to the puzzle that we need to really solve in our communities. There needs to be We need help. We need to get the same amenities that other communities have and begin to work on our communities from the inside out.
And I'm sorry, did you say your son and your nephew were shot?
Yeah, yesterday I had to rush away from the city council meeting and go to KMC Hospital and see about them. But they're okay. One of them's stable. The other one's already at home. One of them has to have a colostomy bag. And it's just crazy, you know.
I am so sorry. So sorry. Well, we certainly wish them a full and a quick recovery. And I'm so sorry that you and your family are having to go through this and deal with this. Trayco, I'd just like to bring you into the conversation. What was your takeaway from those meetings?
I agree with much of what Arlena and Isaiah have stated already. If you remember, during the conversation with the sheriff's office, I presented a potential pattern for restoring trust. And I think that's the goal, is restoring trust between law enforcement and the Black community. And so I gave these four steps: listening, acknowledgement, changed behaviors, and better results that will help us to get to that place of restored trust. I think that BPD has done a much better job of listening than the sheriff's department. I've actually been connected with a number of organizations that are continuing to work in this space, have had conversations with BPD, and Chief Terry is doing a fantastic job of listening to the community. And that's critical. He's also acknowledged some things. I know that both the sheriff's office and BPD made some statements about banning chokeholds and different things. So they've been trying to listen in this space and work in this space. However, I think the commitment has to be sustained. It's got to be something where the listening is ongoing, which is why we've been pushing for an advisory board from the beginning, because this is a start. We know that it's not the end. And in order for trust to be restored, a lot of things still have to take place. We have a long way to go.
You know, several of you have mentioned creating an advisory council. There have been many ideas and proposals that have been floated in the last month and beyond that to reform police. I'm wondering, though, given the current climate in Kern County, what do you think are perhaps the most likely reforms to put in action? Like, what is the low-hanging fruit that could be done immediately or very quickly to help ease the tension between the community and the police department? Trayco, I'll come back to you with that.
Sure. So honestly, that's why I have been a champion of establishing an advisory board, because you can do that pretty quickly. It doesn't take a lot of research, doesn't take a lot of work. All it takes really is a commitment and some conversations with folks who want to be involved and help. To me, that is the lowest hanging fruit. That is the easiest, quickest step that BPD or KCSO can take to improve the listening, the acknowledgement, and kind of the oversight piece or the changed behaviors, and that will lead to better results. We don't know what everything else is going to do in terms of the results. We know that those are lagging indicators, so we're hoping that steps we take result in better results in the long run. But there are some steps you can take immediately, and one of them is, in addition to great words, which we've heard a lot of, let's do something concrete. Let's get an advisory board established and solidified immediately. And it's not hard. There are no laws that would restrict it. There's nothing that says you can't do this. It's a matter of choice. So choose to do that quickly, and I think that would be a huge win for restored trust in the relationship.
Arlena, do you agree?
I absolutely agree. And one of the things, and I've had conversations with Chief Terry and Chief Donnie, long conversations, and we're not always in agreement. But one of the things that they both have said is we want transparency. This has come from both of them. So if they really want transparency, this is definitely a first step in that relationship of transparency. Now, we're going to require the city manager and the city council to take a stand as well, because they have to get involved in this process in order for this to happen as well. So if our elected officials and those who are in leadership truly want to build a relationship with the city, and if they're not just lip service, then this is not a problem. This is something that many have been asking for years, and it hasn't transpired. And so we are left to believe that they are just giving us lip service. If they are not giving us lip service, then this is a done deal. Because we all can agree that there's a problem. The sheriff and the BPD both have agreed that they have issues within their force that has to be fixed. So what's the problem? That's what I think everyone's at the table saying. Why have this not even happened before? You've agreed that the police cannot police themselves anymore. So we all agree on that. So why are we still pushing a request that should have happened years ago? Fresno has already implemented this. We do not have leadership that are standing up for the people, and that is the only way to look at this as to why we're still all at the table asking for the exact same thing to help our community and to help the police officers as well.
Isaiah, you've been involved in the community for a number of years, working to reduce violence on the streets. And I'm wondering if you could provide a little bit of historical context, especially for those people listening who do not live in Bakersfield. So this is a city that made national headlines in 2015 when a study found that its police department was the nation's highest in per capita officer-involved shootings. And then last year, the Bakersfield Californian looked at officer-involved shootings over the past decade and found that more than 80% of the people shot were people of color. So can you just help us understand sort of how we got here and what the long-term relationship has been between law enforcement and the community in Kern County?
I think in a nutshell, how we got here is that law enforcement hasn't listened to the community. And years ago, when there were shootings and we had forums or meetings, we came together to talk to the sheriff, Youngblood, and his organization, and we asked for advisory board. We were shot down. We just, no, we can't do that. Since then, it's been more and more. One man was shot. He was accused of going in the store and buying alcohol for someone. And when he came out of the store, police, the sheriffs, confronted him and shot him. He was unarmed. He was a good man. Everybody knew him in the community. And they shot him dead. And they justified it. And there was an outcry from the community, but nothing happened. So that's been kind of a pattern. It's just, you know, walking while black, just being around while black is can get you shot. So it's been a pattern since then with the police policing police. We don't have a chance as a people, especially when they don't screen the police's enough. And the ones that have infractions or have done things in the community or have been fired from other forces can easily come to another state or city and get hired. You know, it's really bad for the community. I think there should be a lot better screening. There should be more African-American police on the force, brown police, Hispanic. I think that would help. I think if there were some black officers there when Mr. Floyd was killed, I think it might have had a different outcome. I think we need to look at how we can even the playing field, how we can get some more officers of color on the force, and I think it's important. Those things are important. I think the measure in monies also should reflect on how we're going to have healthy communities. We want healthy communities. We want to give all the money to the police. They're the problem right now. I mean, they're a big problem in our communities. We want to show that we as a community can heal our communities from the inside out, from programs like the PAL program, but community ran, and where we teach our youth, where we have after school programs, where we make sure our seniors are okay, where we have food programs, and where we beautify our communities with community gardens, and we build healthy communities. You know, I think some of that money should go toward that instead of just more police cars and more police, more of that. When we as a people have the ability to transform our communities into something beautiful and to bring some hope in the areas where it really needs it.
And Arlena, could you speak to Measure N and the recent decision by the Bakersfield City Council to increase the budget for the police department by 10%?
Well, I think if you watched City Council meeting last night, you were able to see our next generation of leaders and the outcry. And it was a diverse group of people from different socioeconomic levels, races, genders, speaking. And our city council had deaf ears to their cries. When we look at what Measure N was for, and we saw Michael Turnip seat present, who was part of developing Measure N, and he even said, what you all agreed to, you have not kept your word. You've changed. This is not what we approved Measure N for, okay? So it was for the community, and the community is saying, our police department is not working for us. What we need to understand first and foremost is that the police department works for us. Our taxes put food in their families' bellies. So this is not you or power over us. This is you work for us. So there's a cultural problem in the police department right now. So when we look at the way they're allocating money, it is not at the request of the people, which is what they're supposed to do. The people should be involved in the budget a lot more than they are. So to increase the budget by 10%, if we look at that, our city's going to grow. If it makes sense, it should have been some community engagement as it relates to the budget so that people can understand why or how the process comes. You don't bring it to city council for an approval, and that is the first time that the people have been able to hear about this. So I do have a problem in the way in which they went about approving the budget when that budget is the people's budget, but the people are not involved in the process.
And we just have a minute before we wrap up. I'm going to go ahead and let Traco have the last word. What comes next? How do you see the African-American community in Kern County move forward?
Thank you, Kathleen, for inviting us to be part of the conversation. And I'll end with this. I think there has to be a stronger focus on the part of elected officials locally, law enforcement, everyone, on the outcomes. So when you look at the data today, you cannot tell me with a straight face that with the disparities we see in how Black people are treated in the community, that truly we are being treated like neighbors, like we belong as part of this family, this part of this community. That's what has to change. However, the dollars are allocated wherever they go. Initially, at the end of the day, they have to end up supporting things that will help us to feel like we belong. And so it's critical that everyone who leads understands that that's the goal at the end of the day, restoring that trust and achieving better outcomes for the local Black community.
Well, I thank you all for being with us, and thank you for taking the time to share with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. When COVID-19 struck, Every Neighborhood Partnership, a Fresno-based nonprofit, teamed up with local agencies to expand food distribution, give mothers access to diapers and formula, and helped struggling families make ends meet. I spoke with the organization's executive director, Artie Padilla, about his approach to community service, which is to focus on what's working in a community rather than on what's broken.
The needs are so vast. I'm wondering, how do you prioritize where you're putting your energy?
Well, and it's not just my energy. We have a great coalition and network of networks that are working in Fresno County. And so I'm leveraging all of our brain power and financial muscle. And we're constantly going out into the community and getting a pulse from the community themselves of what their felt needs are. So we do that with our existing network of families that we've been working with for years. But, you know, because we're doing all these food distributions, we are doing quick questionnaires while the folks are in the waiting line, because most of these food distributions are drive-by, right? So they stay in their car. So as we get their info, we're asking them, you know, what else is going on in the neighborhood? What do we need to know? So they're telling us what these felt needs are. It's leveraging all these partnerships to work together. The food bank is an amazing partner. We've got organizations like Neighborhood Thrift, which has totally readapted during the COVID season to get their staff to work in the food warehouse to get food out and meals out. So it's just a culmination of 1,000 little things and some big things to know about the felt needs and then to address them in an orchestrated way where we can get the most bang for our buck countywide.
So let's talk a little bit about this idea of assets-based community development. Can you tell us what that is and how it has informed the work that you're doing?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So Every Neighborhood Partnership has been anchored in ABCD, asset-based community development, since we really got intentional about working in neighborhoods with families and youth and developing neighborhood capacity. So ABCD basically is it's both a philosophy, but it's also, there's a methodology to it. So the philosophy is that everyone, when you look at a neighborhood, and ENP looks at the elementary school neighborhoods in Fresno, there's 92 public elementary school neighborhoods in Fresno. And when we look at each neighborhood, we have to look at it individually. We can't cookie cut anything. So, because every neighborhood, the people that live there are different, the demographics are different, the infrastructure is different, what types of stores are different, you know, the lack thereof, whether it's stores or infrastructure, is varied. So it's looking through a lens of assets, of positive. What is in those neighborhoods that are assets? And of course, the number one assets are the people that live in a neighborhood. But then there's assets like a park or a library or a school. There's people in places, and we really want to, what our ABCD does is leverages the assets to address the deficits. Instead of sometimes the old mentality was go into a neighborhood, look at the deficits, maybe find a grant to address a deficit, or even sometimes you get a grant to work in a certain neighborhood or a certain region that tells you what deficit to work on, and then you go into a neighborhood. So that's not what ABCD is. ABCD starts with what is already good in the community, and let's work with what's good to address the felt needs and ultimately empower them to be the leaders of their own neighborhood, not us as ENP or any other organization, but it's the residents that take the lead on that. And that's what we do to empower and equip these residents and youth to do in their own neighborhoods.
I'd also love for you to talk a bit about the work that you're involved with related to trauma and resiliency.
Yeah, so about 3 years ago, myself and some colleagues launched the Fresno County Trauma and Resilience Network. And it honestly was stemmed from the original ACEs study, Adverse Childhood Experiences. That was a study in the 90s, mid to late 90s, where a couple of physicians that really dove into what was happening in the lives of kids in a negative way that has been creating negative health outcomes as they become adults. Because this was a long, 15, 20 year study. And there's been so many studies after that, but that anchoring ACEs study really documented the fact that when kids go through extreme negative environments in the home, in their neighborhood, you know, abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, physical abuse, or things in the home like mental health, major mental health issues in the home, incarceration issues in the home, divorce, things like that, that those adverse experiences are longstanding. They stay ingrained in our bodies and they affect our health as we become adults. But through the ongoing research, we're also realizing that all of us have our own resilience built in us. Some of us have maybe a little bit more, or some of us just don't tap into it as quickly, but it can be brought out. And our brains, although affected by trauma, are not fixed in that area. They can be readjusted through relationships, positive relationships, and reinforced positive love. So, you know, although talking about ABCD earlier, although the ACEs study was kind of deficit focused because of the trauma, it's really brought out the asset part of it, the resilience, the things that can happen in a child's life that can elevate them in areas of their self wellness, you know, how they work well in school with each other. And it's also branched out into, you know, neighborhood trauma, like gangs in the neighborhood, crime, things like that, or even substandard housing. All of these elements are negative impacts in our community. And unfortunately, Fresno has a lot of these traumatic events, both individual trauma and community trauma. But, you know, and that's why it's so important to look at things in a holistic approach. It's not just the physical services for an individual or a family or the mental health services. It's that and how do we build out healthy infrastructure, neighborhoods, and a healthy economy and things like that, because we are holistic individuals and we have to address this holistically with all of the elements of what we call life.
So, of course, in addition to the pandemic, we're also living through a period of civic unrest, of protest, and you're in such a unique position given that you work in partnership with so many different agencies, law enforcement, businesses, churches, community leaders. I'm just curious, what are your thoughts about this moment and what might it mean for us moving forward as a community?
Yeah, so what you honestly have to, if you're really going to look at things, you have to do a big historical context of our country and how it was formed in the beginning, even before 1776. All of this stuff, the formation of our country has been building up and building up and building up and over time. So we are in a place where much like individual trauma, our country has just been dealing with its own trauma. Slavery is probably the most predominant traumatic effect of our country. You know, and sadly, you know, if we just zeroed in on that, slavery in America, you know, science has already shown us that over centuries has altered our African-American women's bodies in the area of childbirth, because we see preterm birth so high in our country and in Fresno County. But also our African-American infant mortality for Fresno is so high, you have to measure it to third world countries across the globe. So, you know, that in it, you know, the research now shows that a lot of this is just stemming from our original sin of slavery in the United States. So I just share that to say that right now we're just at another inflection point of things just popping out. The trauma is just coming out. When we visually see what happened in Minnesota, it just stirred something in our country. And personally, I think those are important things to come out. If you hold things in, eventually things are going to explode. So these are just the manifest. We are living out the manifestations of trauma and inequity and slavery and everything that's come with that and so much more. So I'm not surprised by what's happening. You know, it's like, man, I certainly don't love seeing buildings on fire, but dang, it's like one thing we've learned from trauma and the research is when people reach that tipping point of they just kind of, I don't know, lose control or just get so mad, you are no longer in a functional mindset. You are no longer thinking clearly. That's the research shows that. You basically, that term flip your lid means that your prefrontal cortex is no longer connecting to reason. So, you know, that I'm not trying to make excuses for stuff, but there's a science to all this. And I think it's important for the conversations that have been started need to continue. That's the only way that we get through this and we don't have ongoing issues where the community just gets so tired and fed up and explode again. So we just have to address the deep-rooted issues of our country, the ramifications of that, the manifestation, all the stuff that we see in Fresno, the health disparities, the educational disparities, the economic disparities, all that stuff is just wrapped up in so many of the things from the past to the systems have built upon that over the last, you know, few centuries. So I'm not shocked. I'm hopeful because I see good conversations happening. I'm hopeful that there will be more. I'm so encouraged and proud right now that Fresno has had more conversations than eruptions. I'm proud of our faith leaders, our CBO leaders, our civic leaders. We are addressing it. We need to continue to dive deep into it. That's how I see us really starting to heal over time, is just to address the conversations, but it has to be an honest conversation. It can't be sugar-coated. They've got to be honest conversations.
Well, Artie Padilla, with Every Neighborhood Partnership, thank you for the work that you're doing to serve our community, and thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Cases of COVID-19 are on the rise in the Valley. And to bring us some context is FM89's health reporter, Carrie Klein, with our weekly pandemic update. So last week, we discussed the outbreak inside Avenal State Prison. And today, she's here to talk about data quandaries. Welcome, Carrie.
Hi, Kathleen.
So before we look closely at the data, let's look at the big picture. This week, we saw California set records for the highest daily recorded cases. What happened in the Valley?
So records and record-breaking data are a little bit tough to determine locally, and we'll go into that later. But I will say generally the same thing I did last week, which is that new cases continue to climb throughout the Valley. So do hospitalizations due to COVID, and that's at least in the counties with bigger density of medical centers. And as for a point of comparison, as of Wednesday, we had seen 41 deaths in the past week in our 7-county coverage area. And in the week before that, there had been 34. So there's a rise there as well.
And of course, there's a lot happening and a lot to learn when we drill down to the county level. Give us some highlights from around the Valley.
So in Fresno County, ABC 30 uncovered an outbreak in Fresno County's North Annex Jail, and we've learned some more information about that since then. After initially reporting 13 positive cases, the county sheriff's office tested all the people, over 1,000 incarcerated there, and found that over 100, or nearly 10% of them, had the disease. That situation is ongoing. County health officials also announced earlier this week a third free testing center that they'd be opening up, likely in West Fresno, although the exact location has not been revealed yet. Also, Dicora Transitional Health in Fresno now has the dubious honor of being the deadliest nursing home in the state with 33 fatalities. In Kings and Tulare counties, those two still have the highest density of cases in the San Joaquin Valley. Local health organizations there have teamed up with hospitals and clinics to form a COVID-19 coalition. And in Avenal State Prison, they reported their first two deaths this week among the incarcerated population. That's out of nearly 1,000 cases in total. And the case count at the state prison in Corcoran is creeping up as well. In Kern County, we have our first known case at Mesa Verde ICE Detention Center. That's in a member of the medical staff. And Kingston Healthcare Center in Bakersfield has reported 21 deaths among its nursing home population. It's now got one of the highest death counts of any skilled nursing facilities in the state. And then in Madera, Mariposa, and Merced counties, the caseloads there continue to rise as well.
Well, let's talk more about the data. There are so many numbers here: case counts, case rates, hospitalizations, ICU visits, et cetera. Yet, mystifyingly, there are still gaps and discrepancies in what we know about the disease. Tell me what you found.
Right. So often in public health, the problem with understanding a disease or outbreak is a lack of data. And here with COVID-19, it's almost as if the problem is too much data, but that the data is not calculated entirely consistently between sources. So for instance, we have data dashboards and data sets from every county health department, from the state public health department, from the CDC, and from Johns Hopkins. And these data sets don't necessarily all line up. That's shown in even one of the most basic data points, the new daily case counts. They're different if you're looking at counties or the aggregated state level data. And when I put this question to the Fresno County Health Officer about what to do about this, he just said, when in doubt of data discrepancies, rely on the county data. It's more direct. Another instance of these discrepancies is the so-called positivity rate. That's the ratio of positive tests out of all test results. The state puts a lot of weight on this positivity rate. It's one of the criteria they use when determining if a county can move to the next phase of reopening. But in media calls this week, both Fresno and Kern County health officials said they can't replicate the numbers, the positivity rates that state health officials have calculated. And that's partly because some testing sites only report their positive tests and not their total testing number. And then as for data gaps, there's very little that's known about the ethnic breakdown of cases or fatalities. We know that kind of at a national level, there are some big studies that way, but locally, it's not as clear, and not every county reports that. Fresno County does, but most others in the Valley here do not. There's also very little data about county jails, which we've learned this week as this situation has developed in Fresno County.
So county health departments have data dashboards, so does the state for that matter. These are available to the public for anyone to click through. Do you have any pointers for those people who want to navigate this data themselves?
Right. There are a lot of different things to look at. It can be really confusing if you're just kind of looking everything all together. So the first is that if you're looking for, if you're looking to determine the outbreak size, I should point out that biggest doesn't necessarily mean deadliest. Those are two different counts and they can make a big difference, for specific communities or facilities. Also, as for size, rather than looking at the raw numbers, the total case counts, I prefer to look at the case rate or incidence. That's usually a calculation of the number of cases for every 10,000 or 100,000 people. Because obviously, Los Angeles will have more cases than Madera because it's so much more populous. But by comparing these case rates, you can actually, compare these two cities by looking at the actual density of cases there rather than the raw numbers. Also, if you're looking for some more specific populations, like in nursing homes or correctional facilities, some counties actually have a separate count for those facilities. Kings and Tulare do a good job of that. You can get that at the state level as well. And then, of course, as we've said, demographic data can be hard to get if you're looking for ethnic or racial breakdowns or specific communities. Some counties will have actual maps of where their cases are if you want to know specifically where they're happening in your county, but not every county does.
Well, thank you for all those tips, Carrie. Before we wrap up, I do want to encourage listeners to share their COVID-related stories with us. Easy way to do that is to visit the KVPR app and click on audience feedback. They can record a short message there. So thank you, Carrie. I look forward to talking with you soon.
Okay. Thank you so much.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Are you feeling helpless in the midst of this pandemic? Do you want to assist others, but you just don't know how? Well, there are lots of community benefit organizations or nonprofits that could use your help. They're losing vital funding and human resources, even as they are being asked to deliver more services.
FM89's news director Alice Daniel spoke with Matthew Jindian, the director of the Humanics Program at Fresno State, to find out more about volunteering and giving opportunities.
Matthew Jindian, thank you for joining us on Valley Edition. Perhaps you can start by describing just how hard community benefit organizations have been hit by the pandemic.
So in my position and role at Fresno State as the director of the Humanics Program, we have a lot of contact and interaction with different community benefit organizations serving Fresno and the region. And as such, I've come to hear stories of not only individuals, but organizations that are significantly impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. I think a couple of ways in which that has impacted them. One is financially. Many of the organizations are not able to hold different events or fundraisers that they have traditionally held. So many of those have been canceled. And in-person fundraising with either a meal or silent auctions or other kinds of methods to use to get funds donated to the organization have all had to been put on hold. The second way that organizations have been impacted is in terms of human resources. And what I mean specifically is in terms of volunteers. Many individuals have assumed that many of those organizations may not be operating in the same way that they were prior to the pandemic, but some of them still are, as they are frontline organizations serving people basic needs. And because of that, there's a need still for volunteers, but many people don't realize that.
And I know there's been some coordination in terms of fundraising on a systems level. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so two really exciting things that have been taking place on a systems level that the Humanics Program participated in as well. Recently, through our Students for Giving grant-making program at Fresno State, the Humanics students and scholars made a $7,000 contribution to the United Way's Coronavirus Relief Fund. For those of you who don't know about the Coronavirus Relief Fund, the United Way of Fresno and Madera County has created a local relief fund that directs money to vulnerable families and individuals within Fresno and Madera counties who are facing a financial hardship. There's an application process that individuals go through, and that particular fund was something that was innovatively designed and created by United Way of Fresno Madera County, and that's one of the ways, and people can donate to that at uwfm.org and click on Coronavirus Relief Fund. The other systems level funding that's available for people to contribute to is the Central Valley Community Foundation's COVID-19 Emergency Response Fund. Now, these are both distinct, but at the same time, I would consider both to be systemic ways of fundraising during this COVID-19 pandemic. The United Way Coronavirus Relief Fund provides support directly to families and individuals who are impacted. The Central Valley Community Foundation's COVID-19 Emergency Response Fund provides funding directly to organizations that are serving in three high-priority community needs areas: food and essential services, support for frontline health workers, and coordination of resources. I want to point out that it's important, I think, for all of us to think about ways that we can leverage our dollars. And sometimes it's better to contribute to a systemic fundraising effort than an individual fundraising effort.
So one way people can assist, even if they are hesitant to leave their homes, is by giving financially. What are some other ways people can help right now? I know you mentioned organizations have fewer volunteers. Are there still ways that people can do hands-on work?
Yes, so there are two ways that people can get involved. Other than giving of their treasure, they can also give of their time. And they can give of their time through volunteering either in a virtual way, literally from their own home, or from getting involved in a direct service way if they are healthy and able to go out and be in a frontline service type position. There are precautions that each organization takes to ensure that in-person volunteers are protected, that their health status is protected. And I would suggest individuals look at different organizations. If they're wanting to go and volunteer, either in a virtual way or in person, one of the websites that I refer people to is volunteermatch.org. But I also recommend that individuals can go directly to the organization's website of their choosing. So you could go to, for example, Central California Food Bank, and you can click on volunteer, and it can take you through a process of what kinds of things that they need people to do. And every organization, whether it's Every Neighborhood Partnership or Focus Forward or Centro La Familia, every organization typically has a volunteer section on their website of how to get involved in a way that you want to be involved.
And in terms of organizations having fewer volunteers, are they coming up with unique ways of getting around that, or are they just really feeling the pinch?
So they're feeling the pinch because of the shortage of volunteers. Many people not feeling safe in general, or many people hesitant or thinking that none of these operations are going on. But Central California Food Bank, Focus Forward, Central La Familia, these are examples of organizations that are frontline organizations. And they are continuing to do in-person service. And they have had to, as a result of statewide regulations, change their procedures for how people volunteer. And so I just want to make that very clear, that the organizations have had to adapt in order to make sure that they are providing a safe and healthy environment for which people to volunteer. And so there are rules about temperature taken. Volunteers who serve in person cannot be actively ill. They cannot have a fever for the past 24 hours. And then they're ensuring distancing and other kinds of precautions within the volunteer service environment to allow people to contribute, but do so in a safe manner.
And one last question, where are you seeing the greatest needs right now?
I would say the greatest needs are in the areas actually that I mentioned that Central Valley Community Foundation had focused on. The primary area is food and essential services, including health. And so the organizations that are working in these areas, Red Cross, for example, again, Central La Familia, Central California Food Bank, these are organizations that have very high priority needs because the needs have grown significantly because of the economic impact that the pandemic has had. And so we find more residents who are in need for services. And at the very time that the need has grown, the ability for the organization, both financially and from a human resource perspective in terms of volunteers, has declined, and therefore limiting the organization's ability to meet those growing needs.
So it looks like there's lots of ways to give right now. Thank you so much, Matthew, for joining us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. This week we spoke to a musician who, like others, lost a lot of work when the pandemic hit. Performances were postponed or canceled altogether. Patrick Contreras, a Fresno violinist, started to offer front lawn concerts to make ends meet, and the idea has taken off. FM89's Laura Satsui spoke to Contreras about where the idea came from and how he performs safely. Contreras starts by explaining the origins behind a song he often plays called Tacos and Tijuana.
I don't have lyrics to my music, so I like to paint stories with my music. And this song is about a trip with my guy friends and our first band experience. We go to San Diego, we play this venue. It's like a five-hour gig. We get paid probably all of $75, but to us, we had made it. You know, we're 19-year-old guys and we're starving. We're like, I got to eat, I'm so hungry, but we can't get in anywhere because we're not 21. And I was like, oh, come on, guys. We didn't come all the way to San Diego to eat Denny's. We can do that in Fresno. I got a better idea. Let's go to Tijuana and get some tacos. And they're like, what? Dude, it's 2 in the morning. And I'm like, what better time to get tacos than Tijuana? 2 a.m. Let's go, you know? So and I'm painting this journey of going through Tijuana in the middle of the night, 4 guys in a taxi, and then we get off and eat the best tacos of our lives. And that's what the song's about. I've been throwing it as an encore in a lot of my sets because it's my own music and I want people to know what I sound like. And oh my gosh, it's so funny. I'll have, because I play the song and I'm telling the story as I play the song. I'm not just saying that because it's my song, but like it's funny because it shakes down people's, that breaks down people's wall. People are laughing because everybody can relate in some way or another. If they haven't gone to Tijuana, you know, someone at some other time in their life has done something crazy late at night, and I've played it for every demographic and people get a kick out of it. It's fun. It all kind of came like in an avalanche. I got these, the emails started trickling in. Hey, you know, I apologize. We're going to have to cancel this year or we're going to cancel. Then it just turned into a flood of cancellations over a period, I'd say, of a week and a half, 2 weeks. Everybody kind of just had to cancel, which, and you can't get upset. That's what has to be done. So I wasn't upset at them or anything. It was more of just a shock of, oh, you're seeing all your work disappear. And so I kind of had to figure out something and be creative. A light bulb came on because I do these little portable shows for senior facilities and also for like the fairs. A lot of fairs hire me, from Oregon State Fair to Orange County Fair. And this skill that I've kind of developed through the fairs, I thought to myself, you know what? It's a perfect time to do this now. I can come right to people's front door. I put on my notes. I require a 15-foot distance. Yeah, I can come to your driveway. I go to the sidewalk and I perform for people. And it's absolutely revolutionized my career in the sense that my social media, for one, has jumped up 3,000 or 4,000 likes on both my Instagram and Facebook individually. And my name's out there more than it ever had. And the demand has been crazy. Just handling all of it, I had to hire a helper just to full-time answer all the booking requests. It really blew up. It just turned into a whole big thing. You know, people who are stuck inside, maybe they haven't seen their parents in months, grandparents in months, and they want to do something nice. So they come and sit in their car. I play in the front yard for the grandparent. The grandparent might just come sit on the porch, and it's something. So it's a little bit of that. It's a little bit of people just wanting some music. Everything above. There has not been one singular thing experience other than when it's, say, Mother's Day or Father's Day. They specifically want something. But other than that, no, it's been quite a mix. And there's this quote that always stuck with me, where words fail, music speaks. And music is a soother. And I, since I'm playing for everybody, you know, I always make this joke with my wife. I'm playing from the hood to the Woodbridge Park hood, to the East Side hood, the West Side hood, the South Side hood, Central, everywhere. There's not one type of person that I'm playing for, and everybody wants music, and everybody needs music. And my hope is when I play that people are having fun, but I also want to soothe people. There's a lot of upset and angry and just frustration on all sorts of different walks of life. And I hope that no matter what or where they stand on things, that my music can be just something to soothe a little bit, soothe the soul.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. And we'd love to hear from you, especially your experiences around the pandemic. Send us a voice memo on our app. Just hit the audience feedback icon and record. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Laura Satsui, Carrie Klein, and Madi Bolaños. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.